Well, good morning. It's good to be here with all these people. Insofar as civil society is conceived of as the arena of uncoerced collective action around shared interests, purposes, and values, generating social capital for the common good, religion may seem a poor candidate as a contributor. For polemical attack and contestation seem foundational for many religious traditions. It could be argued that religious traditions are born in polemic, that they did not achieve definition except through some sort of conflictual relationship with other contending visions. This seems to be true, at least in the cases of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the major religious traditions with which I'm most familiar. It seems that their foundational origin stories enshrined in their scriptural texts are saturated with a sense of the crucial necessity of, and of course ambiguity about, separating or making distinctions from other options. The Tanakh, the Jewish scripture, is laced with a foreboding sense that the Israelites must set themselves apart from the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Canaanites, and the other other peoples and behaviors and the ideologies associated with them, or else suffer extreme consequences. The New Testament is likewise imbued with conflict between contending viewpoints: Jesus versus the scribes and Pharisees, Paul versus his opponents, the church versus the claims of the empire. And the Quran clearly manifests a polemical context vis-a-vis Jews, Christians, and Arabian polytheists. Now, particular traditions within these religions are also often forged in the fires of polemic and argumentation and contestation. The Christian tradition with which I identify, or which gives me my core religious identity, that is, Lutheranism, is no exception. Lutheran Christianity was born in the polemics of the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther is known for his polemical stances, especially vis-a-vis the papacy and the Roman Church of his time, but also against the Jews, other Protestants, and the Turks. Bishop Munib Yunan of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land has very helpfully outlined Luther's polemical stance insofar as it potentially relates to interfaith dialogue and relationships today. Starting with Luther's stance over against the Jews of his time. In his earlier writings, Luther advocated a friendly and kind relationship of Christians with Jews, arguing that thereby many Jews might convert to Christianity. He even published a pamphlet entitled "That Jesus Christ Was Born a Jew." However, in his later writings, while continuing to maintain that both Jews and Christians shared in the common human attempt to earn their own righteousness and to resist the grace of God, he began to advocate extremely harsh persecution of Jews by the Christian authorities. Similarly, Luther's views on the Turks, and the Turks, of course, were the face of Islam for the northern Europeans of Luther's time, showed both a continuing theological portrayal, but also a development in practical recommendations. While Luther consistently viewed the Turks as followers of a false religion, he nonetheless insisted that they were a God-sent scourge to punish a sinful Christendom. He expressed admiration for their way of life and piety, which he saw as superior to the religious customs among the Christians of his day, and he counseled Christians living under Turkish rule to obey their political overlords as being appointed by God. He succeeded in getting a ban on the publication of a Latin translation of the Quran lifted. However, as the Turkish threat loomed ever larger, the Turks having besieged Vienna in 1529, education and admiration were not enough. Whereas in his explanation earlier on of the 95 Theses, Luther had argued, quote, "To fight against the Turk is the same as resisting God, who visits our sin upon us with this rod." He later argued that the Christian authorities were obliged to wage war against the Turks. Although he refused attempts to turn defensive military action against the Turks into a religious crusade. By the way, it's really odd for me to talk about this when there are guests from Turkey here. But we are in the past here, right? Okay. In his polemical stance over against the Jews and the Turks, Luther was highly influenced by an apocalyptic discourse that saw the end of the world as nigh and that encouraged the demonization of opponents as participants in a cosmic battle between God and the devil. So that's the roots of my tradition. And I hate polemic. I find it distasteful. So why? I mean, many have pointed out the positive characteristics and consequences of polemic, arguing that change and innovation rarely take place without polemic. And indeed, I mean, there's my roots in Lutheranism, but my other roots are in the academy. I teach at a university. And polemic used to be one of the tools of the academy, and still is to some extent, although now it is generally eschewed or avoided. Jonathan Crew is an English professor, I believe, who's looked at this and has traced how since the 1960s there's sort of been a growing aversion to polemic in the academy for various reasons. And that now the demand for civility, respect, negotiation, and collective endeavor trumps what is seen as an embarrassing, if not pathological, desire of academic warrior critics to annihilate their opponents. And I'm glad of that. I like that, right? And we might agree that this is all to the good. The word polemic, after all, is derived from the Greek polemos and polemikos, war and warlike. In an interview in 1984, shortly before his death, Michel Foucault, and you always have to quote Foucault in academic papers, right, made the following connection between polemic and war, and these words are great. He says, the polemicist proceeds encased in privileges that he possesses in advance and will never agree to question. On principle, he possesses rights authorizing him to wage war and making that struggle a just undertaking. The person he confronts is not a partner in the search for truth, but an adversary, an enemy who is wrong, who is harmful, and whose very existence constitutes a threat. For him, then, the game consists not of recognizing the person as a subject having a right to speak, but of abolishing him as an interlocutor from any possible dialogue. Now, Jonathan Crew warns, however, against the dangers of thus marginalizing and cordoning off polemic or intellectual aggression in general. Such a move obscures the inescapable polemical formulation of the stance against polemic. It closes discussion on the possible tempering, mediating, modulation, and regulating of the excesses of polemic, and it does not acknowledge the pleasure and fertility of polemic. So I'm kind of stuck here. Like, you know, I don't like polemic. I want the other pole is irenics, based on the Greek word for peace. But polemic has a lot of energy in it, and it causes some of these benefits as well. So how can we move in a good way between these two? Therefore, polemic is not just to be criticized for its troublesomeness, but must be examined for its potential as a possible source for innovation and for how it can itself be transformed in less denigrating and aggressive directions. Are there clues in my tradition, in the Lutheran tradition, that point not to polemics, but to irenics as a framework for relating to those who are other, who differ in their practice and beliefs? And I want to just highlight two possibilities. One is a German phrase that goes leise treten, treading softly. And the other is a theology of the cross. Leise treten, to tread softly and lightly, is taken from Martin Luther's evaluation of the Augsburg Confession, a presentation of the doctrine of the Reformers, written by his colleague Philip Melanchthon, for presentation at the Augsburg Council, called by the Emperor Charles V to resolve the differences between the old believers and the dissenting evangelicals. And this is what Luther writes. I have read Master Philip's Apologia. It pleases me very well, and I can find nothing therein to change or improve. It is also likely to be better this way, since I cannot tread so softly and lightly. Leise treten. All right? May Christ our Lord help that it produces much good and great fruit as we hope and pray. Amen. See, Luther, the Apology is a very Irenic document. Luther's writings tend not to be that way. So the trouble is, commentators have looked at what Luther said here in two different lights. Some have said this treading lightly is, they write that off as Luther saying that Melanchthon was pussyfooting around and being deceptive, and or even it's Melanchthon's Irenic stance is seen as a downright treason of the truth. But Luther himself, I would claim, saw it as diplomatic dexterity and a moderate approach that he himself could not emulate. He said, because I am hot-blooded by temperament and my pen gets irritated easily. Okay. So Leise treten is thus a label for an approach or a hermeneutic, if you will, that eschews the hateful and injurious rhetoric that polemic is prone to in favor of an Irenic approach that invites a dialogue or conversation. Not that to tread lightly means to give up convictions or to fall into the abyss of relativism. This Irenic discourse can still rightfully indicate the boundary markers between different religious traditions, however, without tracing them with barbed wire that cuts and excludes. Now, the other helpful element from the Lutheran tradition is this strange thing known as the theology of the cross. And I can't go on at length with this. Dietmar Mundell yesterday in his presentation talked a bit about it. And all I want to really say about that is that what it indicates in sort of a core conviction that God reveals God's self where it is least expected. For Christians, that is in the suffering of Christ on the cross. And so Christians are called to be humble, to avoid relating to their other fellow citizens of other faith traditions, now particularly Muslim fellow citizens, with a theology of glory that presumes to have the final and exclusive answers. McGrath, who writes about the theology of the cross, has this to say. The theology of the cross passes judgment on the church where she has become proud and triumphant or secure and smug, and recalls her to the foot of the cross, there to remind her of the mysterious and hidden way in which God is at work in the world. So, the task given to the speakers for this, that was all prolegomena. The task given to the speakers for this section of the symposium was to identify a concrete and recent example within their traditions of their ways of responding to the struggles found in the communities of another tradition. Now, I don't have one nice, big, concrete example the way that our last speaker was able to enunciate, but rather a series of instances that are all kind of groping towards the reality of concrete examples. But they're recent, and they deal with offering aid to Muslim communities by Christians in today's world in dealing with a very dire problem, and that's the problem of Islamophobia. Okay? Islamophobia, or the feelings of fear and hatred of Muslims simply because they are Muslims, as well as discriminatory action against Muslims based on this fear or hatred, while it's been a constant reality of the long history of Christian-Muslim relations, waxing and waning depending on historical circumstances, has loomed particularly large in today's world. The favorite expression of Islamophobia is polemical. Luther would be at home. Two recent items illustrate to me just how serious the problem of Islamophobia has become for Muslim communities living in North America. Last month, a Muslim group held a fundraiser in Orange County, California, to raise money for a women's shelter and for the homeless. Hundreds of anti-Muslim protesters showed up and verbally harassed those attending the event, including families with children entering the doors of the venue, shouting, "Go back home," asking the men whether they beat their wives, all the while chanting, "USA, USA." You can see this. It's a video. You can see it. It's easy to find. It horrified me. If this were not bad enough, local and national political leaders showed up to encourage the protesters. One Republican congressman told the crowd, "I'm proud of you. I'm proud of what you are doing." While a local councilwoman said, "I know quite a few Marines who will be willing to help these terrorists to an early meeting in paradise." I hate to bring this kind of stuff into this symposium, which has been so good but this is a reality that's out there. A second one is a recent report in the Washington Monthly, which we were discussing in my class this past week. She describes how independent, entrepreneurial, self-styled counterterrorism experts are being hired to train local police forces in how they can contribute to the war on terror, and how these individuals inculcate a virulent form of Islamophobia that paints all Muslims as deceptive liars and potential subversives. In fact, the example that the Washington Monthly article talks about is about a person who, when asked, they gets them all worked up, the local police force, and then they say, "Well, what can we do?" And he says, "What I counsel you to do is legal harassment of anyone who's a Muslim, and that's considered a strategy that they should engage in." So given this Islamophobic background, it is no wonder that a Gallup mental health survey last year found that over one quarter of Muslim youth in the United States reported feeling angry, and less than half considered themselves as thriving. And that these are the worst figures for youth of different faith groups and in the general American population. Now, this poll and the preceding examples are admittedly American, but Canadians are rarely far behind in many American trends, multiculturalism notwithstanding. In any case, these examples of Islamophobia and its consequences point to a significant and potentially debilitating problem faced by Muslim communities in North America. The question I'd like to consider is how Christians can help their Muslim fellow citizens in tackling this problem and thus contribute constructively to building up a pluralistic civil life that contributes to the common good. Now, while teaching, where does this come from? While teaching an introductory course on Islam via distance education, I received a term paper from an off-site student entitled Muhammad and Jesus, Each Very Different and Unique. Sounds like a not bad paper. The paper compared the founders of Islam and Christianity, but compared them in terms that were very favorable to Jesus and extremely negative and denigrating to Muhammad. It soon became apparent that most of the paper was not the student's own work. In fact, the student had plagiarized the paper almost entirely word for word from two polemical Christian anti-Muslim internet sites, answeringislam.org and thechristianexpositor.org. Now, this experience brought home to me that the internet has not only become the default option for locating information quickly and efficiently and an easy source for cut-and-paste plagiarism, we all know we have to deal with that, but also that it makes accessible to unsuspecting students and others unreliable information from acutely biased sources. More specifically, the internet has become a ready source for anti-Muslim polemical discourses, and the unsuspecting person can draw them up easily. This experience led me to a case study in which I analyzed the interpretations of the Bible and the Quran on a selected anti-Muslim Christian site, answeringislam.org, and also a selected Muslim anti-Christian website. So it works on the other way around too, answeringchristianity.com. And some of the results of the study include that adamant, predetermined theological convictions guide these interpretations of Scripture. They are not open readings inviting examination and dialogue. Secondly, a feature of these polemics is exclusive binaries. It's either one way or the other. There's no other possibility. A rigid drawing of lines between two alternatives, one of which must be totally true and the other which must be totally false. And thirdly, these websites do draw on scholarship, but it is a gratuitous and selective use of scholarship. Only what is close at hand, often what you can grab off of online, and what supports one's argument is used without regard to the scholarly conventions with which this sort of material has been produced. And when I presented these results at the American Academy of Religion meetings as kind of a warning to what the kind of work that scholars are doing in Christianity and Islam, to what use it can sometimes be put. Now, while in this case I analyzed both Christian anti-Muslim online polemic and Christian and Muslim anti-Christian online polemic, it is clear that the latter is responding to the initiative of the former, and also that the Christian anti-Muslim polemic enjoys far more web traffic. The experience of the analysis I found... maybe I'm not supposed to talk anymore. The experience of the analysis...
There's a couple guys up there. I don't know what they're doing.
Oh, good. There we go. The experience of the analysis I found quite disorienting and overwhelming. There seemed to be an energy and vigor in this world of interreligious polemic where everything was continually pounding home the same assumed truths in endless series of hyperlinked and cascading self-referential and self-confirming discourses. It was really disorienting, getting lost in it. The question is, can that alternately frightening and seductive energy be harnessed in more productive directions? Another source of Islamophobic material, also online, is found in extremely virulent anti-Muslim emails that are sent around like chain letters. I don't know if some of you have received these, right? My students, have drawn my attention to these, for they and members of their families often receive them, and they come to class saying, is this true? Like, what is that? Because they're innocent. They don't know. They include emails claiming alarming information such as statistics demonstrate that Islam will overwhelm Christendom. Barack Obama is a radical Muslim who will not recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Hamas mass wedding for 450 little girls, etc. A very popular one that you'll find circulating in many different ways is a piece entitled, Can a Good Muslim Be a Good American? And it lists some 9 to 10 reasons for answering this question with a resounding no, and concludes, perhaps we should be suspicious of all Muslims in this country. They obviously cannot be both good Muslims and good Americans. And, I feel sorry for these students who come and say, what is this? My tendency, perhaps shared by many of you, is to angrily delete such awful attempts to evoke suspicion and fear of all Muslims in general. I think it is necessary, however, for such emails to receive a response based on a measured analysis of their malicious and false content. While some websites are available to help debunk the message of these emails, such as Loonwatch and Snopes, I believe, specific answers that ironically refute the charges need to be composed and made available to those who receive such emails so that they can be sent out in response. And that's sort of a project that I'm trying to initiate right now. The final source of Islamophobic material and sentiment, which I briefly would like to mention, is the slew of popular authors who hawk their personal stories of personal tragedy and abuse as Muslims as narratives that accurately describe the Muslim world in general. That they do so usually with the generous financial backing of fundamentalist Christian groups and or right-wing think tanks such as the American Enterprise Institute should make one immediately suspicious. I'm thinking of authors such as Ayan Hirsi Ali, the Canadian Irshad Manji, Wafa Sultan, and Noni Darwish. Just this past week, my university president hosted the second annual leadership conference, big event for the University of Regina, aimed especially at women in the province of Saskatchewan. The event sold out, even though tickets were $200 for the one-day event. The keynote speaker, Ayan Hirsi Ali. Now, my colleague at Luther College, Brenda Anderson, who teaches women gender studies and Islamic studies with me, and I, as soon as we, of course, you don't hear about these plans are made quite outside the purview of anybody who knows anything about these things. When we heard about it late last fall, we immediately requested an audience with, and received an audience with the university president and to present our concerns. And of course, things had advanced to such a state that no adjustments could be made in the schedule, no other voice could be added. But we did manage to wring out of her a financial commitment to bring some other speakers in, and so we're working on getting people like Tariq Ramadan and others into the university. All right. Now, these examples of anti-Muslim polemic on websites and viral emails and best-selling books potentially exert an enormous influence on the perceptions of non-Muslims and Muslims alike in the Western world, functioning to widen gaps instead of building bridges, engaging in warfare rather than peace, going well beyond the establishment of helpful boundary markers by instead erecting barbed wire barriers, trampling loudly and proudly rather than stepping calmly and diplomatically. These materials only confirm and intensify pre-existing prejudices instead of encouraging critical examination and actual contact. This is the problem that Muslim communities suffer and which the Christian community is called to help with, especially since so much of this material presumes a Christian antipathy to Muslims. It presumes that Christians will be very open to it, and that's sad. Now, I don't have time to more than simply enumerate some of the faltering steps that have been undertaken under the umbrella of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, things that I've been involved in encouraging Christians to have a better informed understanding of Muslims and to therefore have the tools and information with which to counter within themselves and their neighbors this rising tide of anti-Muslim sentiment. And I think that's a calling that Christians in North America are called to do this. I sat on a committee that was called together by Bishop Schultz at that time, acting was the bishop at the time of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. It's vaguely, I mean, sort of ambiguous, called the Muslim Relations Committee. And of a number of people from all segments, all the synods of the church, which met several times over a period of about 3 years, talking about ways in which the church could do exactly this work that I've been outlining. And it led, unfortunately, the committee was dissolved. The church is in has financial pressures, and it didn't survive. However, it did lead to a number of results. It led to a template that was made for how congregations, a template that congregations could use to initiate relationships with and dialogue with neighboring Muslim communities and sort of host an event either to educate themselves or to do an event together and so on. That hasn't been promulgated, but it's there ready to be used. But maybe more importantly, this committee provided the impetus for presentations and on this work at on both the synodical and congregational level. And so I can just describe several of the things that I was involved in. Most recently, I gave the Marvin Dubrick lectures at Luther Hostel, which is an event that the Waterloo Lutheran Seminary, one of the two seminaries that trains pastors for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, out in Waterloo, holds every spring. And this is an event not just for, it's an event for pastors, continuing education. It's also an event for lay people to come and get educated along with their pastors. It's a great event, actually. And so I was able to do four presentations, and my colleague there, Tim, did marvelous work in joining that with visits to various area mosques and cultural events and so on. And so, what were these four? What did we talk about? Well, we talked about things like this. The first session was, what do Muslims really think? Because, and that's drawing on the, there's a worldwide Gallup poll that has gone in all kinds of countries in the world, including all the Muslim majority countries, and has asked ordinary people what they think about all, you know, violence, and what they think about politics, and what they think of the U.S., and so on. And, you know, what Muslims really think is not what you find in these polemical sources. Okay, so that was, that really helps. A second session was on reading the Bible and the Quran hand in hand or side by side, which is always very illuminating for Christians who recognize so many of the Quranic narratives, the same people, stories of Abraham and Moses and Jesus in there. A third session dealt with, and this is a sort of thing that I really like doing a lot, is dealing with the sitcom Little Mosque on the Prairie. My Zarka Nawaz is a friend of mine, and she's a Regina filmmaker, and she's of course the creative impetus behind this sitcom. And I talk about it in relationship to efforts to build what I call a Canadian convivencia. And convivencia is a word that is used by historians to describe the Andalusian experiment. The time when Muslims ruled what is present-day Spain and Portugal, and during which time, some of that time, there was, there were large communities of Muslims, Christians, and Jews living together in a more or less Irenic fashion, all right? And how we could use that inspiration of that time period in terms of constructing a modern-day convivencia in Canada. And I relate that to what Little Mosque is trying to do in a humorous fashion, right? And then finally, the final session was on fighting the gender jihad, which is, focusing on Muslim women in various parts of the world and who are out of their Muslim tradition, struggling for the rights as women that they believe their faith gives them, all right, in which they feel that they're denied in many cases. So, it's very eye-opening. I mean, some pastors, even, who are relatively educated people, coming and saying, I've never heard that voice before or heard that perspective before, and that was really good. Various other things, the Augustana Distinguished Lectures were on this subject. Friends of Lutheran Campus Ministry Banquet, actually that's happening tonight. Last year I was the speaker, and it was on this subject. We had a session, Meeting Our Muslim Neighbors, that was at the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada National Convention in Vancouver in 2009. I brought Zarka Nawaz to the Pastor's Study Conference in Saskatchewan in 2008. Lots of presentations in various Lutheran and Anglican congregations in Regina and southern Saskatchewan. Often, not always, but often bringing Muslim guests along. My friend Mosa Bajaber from Saudi Arabia. Aza Askar, an engineer in Regina. These just... good things to do. Sometimes you have to be careful with congregations who aren't ready to listen to a Muslim, but they're ready to maybe listen to me and then listen to a Muslim. So it's interesting work. And the basic presuppositions I try to bring across are things that they're kind of like what you learn in kindergarten about relating to people. The golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So what, this polemical stuff, Number two, when trying to understand a religion that is not your own, ask the adherents of that religion, not its enemies. Good. Makes sense, right? Number three, compare best to best and worse to worse. So often people do the other thing. They look at their religion, all the good things that they idealize their religion, and look at another religion and look at all the bad things that they can drag up about it. And that's totally unfair. Compare best to best and worse to worse. Now, we're quite willing to follow these rules. At least I find that the community, the North American communities, are quite willing to follow these rules when it comes to other religious groups. And when it comes to Muslims, they kind of hesitate. And that's what the churches need to work on overcoming. So I'm actually all close to finishing. So just to draw these threads together, I thought I'd put together some conclusions or some lessons that we can learn. Like what I'd like to see us do, and I'm still groping towards how to conceptualize this, is harnessing that energy from polemic to get to an irenics that's critical. Okay, not just like, I really don't like this binary thinking where it's just, you know, that's polemical. Like there's only polemic and then there's irenic and you better choose which side you're on. Rather, to move from the energy of polemic to a critical irenics. That's better for friendship in a ways. Who wants a friend who's just kind of pretending that they like you, right? But you want a friend who's deeply engaged with you and is willing to question you as well, call you out on your behavior and still accept you as a human being, right? So what do we do about this Islamophobic polemical discourse? What's some lessons for particularly the Christian community? Islamophobic polemical discourse is pervasive and predatory. Therefore, it cannot simply be ignored or discounted. Rather, Christians need to be given the tools and information to both resist and correct such propaganda as part of their call to be good neighbors to their Muslim fellow citizens. As a corollary, polemic itself, you know, is a form of rhetoric that should generally be avoided, in that it rarely succeeds in getting at the truth, but rather wounds and solidifies barriers. A second lesson I draw from this is that the power of Islamophobic polemical discourse depends on meeting Muslims only through distorted media representations. It thus functions to confirm prejudice rather than question it. Christians need to seek the opportunity to meet real live Muslims, to overcome the anxiety that often leads to resisting real encounter with the other, and to support alternate and accurate media representations of Muslims. And finally, this is very much more specific to Lutherans. Lutherans and other Christian groups composed of those who can still remember their immigrant experiences or those of their relatively recent forebears should be able to draw on those experiences in order to engender empathy with their Muslim fellow citizens. Just as German Lutherans were ostracized and distrusted in the past, so also you should be able to understand what's happening to your fellow Muslim citizens today. That's all I have. Thanks.